listening to KKCR Hanalei KAQA Kilauea, the station that loves you, at 91.9 FM and www.kkcr.org, streaming all over the place worldwide. So today, February 2nd, we have three guests in here. We're going to be talking about a whole lot of different materials. But I am going to introduce my guests, and then we're going to hear from our underwriters, the kind folks that help create this type of programming for the listener on Kauai to be able to hear. So I have Christopher Schroeder. Christopher, put your mouth to the mic.
Aloha.
There he is, and he is he's a small farm manager, and he does a good job. So, you know, he's going to be helping me a little bit with some of my agriculture discussion. And then I have Jeffrey Jackson. Jeffrey, say hi.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, he's in here, too. And he's an investigative journalist, and he is creating a lot of different help for me. And then who will be in here soon is Bridget Hammerquist. So, Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with Kauai Stores and Bikram Yoga.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect those of KKCR, its management, staff, board, members, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Kauai Store is located in Kapa'a on the highway in front of Kostulas. The store has authentic Kauai products, including clothing, snacks, art, coffee, crafts, and more. We even have local food samples. The Kauai Store products are also available online at thekauaistore.com.
Bikram Yoga Kauai, located in Kapa'a, provides authentic Bikram Yoga. A 90-minute beginner's series is practiced in a heated studio with newly remodeled hot showers and changing rooms. All levels welcome. Improves physical health and overall well-being. Boutique open and classes available 7 days a week. KauaiBikramYoga.com or 823-9642.
KKCR listens to you. If you'd like to make comments or provide feedback regarding our programming, or to suggest programming you'd like to hear, go to KKCR.org, click on the contact link, and take our listener survey. Or send us a letter at KKCR, P.O. Box 825, Hanalei, Hawaii 96714. Kauai Community Radio, listening to you.
This is Jennifer Waipa, park ranger at Kilauea Point National Wildlife Refuge and home of the Daniel K. Inouye Kilauea Point Lighthouse. We want to let everyone know that the refuge, lighthouse, and nature store will be closed January 19th through April 30th. We will do our best to reduce the length of closure, but addressing erosion, undermining, and settling that are occurring along the pathway to the point is critical for public safety and visitation. We appreciate your patience and understanding. Mahalo.
And mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio. So, Marshall, I want to make sure you're mic'd up too.
Aloha, Felicia.
Okay, there he is. So we were looking before we came on air at just the almost avalanche of public issues that are out right now. Most of them are because this is the start of the legislative season. The presidential race is also under full swing.
Yes, it is.
So when we have the legislative season, that is 90 working days. So a ton of materials come before our legislator. And a lot of them, how can I put this the right way? The people who are the most able to push bills are the ones who have money to be made if those bills pass. So the difficult thing is the average citizen, sometimes, maybe they have something to gain. Very often they have something like a personal choice that might be coming away from them. So they have to really be diligent. It costs a lot of money to fly over there. What is great is we've got this really excellent website called www.capital.hawaii.gov. So we're able to put our voices in, make a difference, and a lot happens really on social networking. So one of these things that's big that's happening this week is all these right-to-farm bills that, again, are designed to protect big agriculture from their neighbors who might not like their behavior. But there's also, you know, small agriculture has a lot of its own conflicts. Sometimes small agriculture isn't powerful enough to be looking after its interests, and, you know, there can even be infighting amongst the small farms, and what does create an impact is oftentimes the CCNRs, what stands for conditions, covenants, and restrictions inside these agricultural subdivisions. So some of them are better than others. But so we have some challenges with that. Other things that are going to be coming up on the show is definitely these mandatory vaccinations. There was a bill that went before the Senate today. It got deferred, but we're going to be talking about that. There's seven bills that are looking to do mandatory vaccinations, and that one is a little unnerving to me and many other parents because not everybody thrives with a vaccination. There might be a good intention, but it doesn't always have a good outcome. As we weave through our conversation today, there will be places where we talk about what's happened and is happening at the Planning Commission, the Charter Review Commission, the County Council, many, many different issues. But I want to start off with talking about what works in agriculture. And that'll be what comes up first. Before that, let's go through a list. There's a number of events that are happening in the community, and so we'll just be able to share them out pretty quickly for people so they don't miss an important opportunity. Do you want to start with that, Marshall?
Well, there's Glenn Hunt's funeral. We should remember that.
Oh, right. Glenn Hunt. He definitely has been super, super helpful in all of our agriculture, sustainable agriculture efforts.
So it's February 13th at 5 p.m. at the Kaloa Union Church. And in lieu of flowers, donations are preferred for the food ministry.
Okay. And then another person that we talked about a little bit last week, Jumbo Fu, Wendell Fu, amazing man as well. Very loved, particularly on the North Shore here. His funeral is going to be, his service is going to be Saturday, February 20th at Waipa over at the Fish Pond, and that's going to start about 9:30. So there's that. Okay.
Oh, we have some workshops coming up. We have some great workshops coming up. There is one on mushroom cultivation, and that's being put on by Regeneration's Botanical Garden. It's this coming Sunday at the Kauai Food Forest.
In Kalihiwai.
Mm-hmm. It's 9 to 1 p.m., and Tammy Davis is teaching that. And you can register for that on ribg.org.
I'm definitely going to that one. I don't know, Christopher, if you follow mycelium and mushrooms and how great they are at rejuvenating the soil and bioremediating things. I actually hope that we have some of our, if not at that meeting, that at some of the meetings that maybe we can bring our public works people in there because I think it's very important for reclaiming our soil that might be exhausted.
Yeah, I'll definitely be there as well, Felicia, and I've been saving all my coffee grounds for the last few months, waiting to get started on my own mushroom cultivation projects, so I encourage everybody to do that. When you're done making coffee in the morning, just throw them in a bag in the freezer until you got enough to start growing some oysters.
Yep, that's wonderful, and I can hear a little echo in the room. I just want to let the listener know KKCR is always trying to work on its updates, and so right now we got all the sound muffling stuff is ripped off the walls, the carpets, everything else, so you're hearing a little bit of an echo. But we can work through that.
Okay, there's also a workshop coming up on kava, and I definitely want to be at that one too. It sounds fascinating. It's going to be on February 28th with Gary Mack and Paul Massey, and you can go to ribg.org and sign up for the newsletter on the lower right to be informed about that, or you can just stay tuned to the website. And, of course, there's the seed exchange coming up. And that is going to be great. It always is. It's on March 13th at Ninaho Community Park. You can also see details at ribg.org.
And Ninaho is also known as the Kauai Mini Golf that's in Kilauea. So that's a really good one. And if anybody wants to help and volunteer for that, we're definitely in the prep part. Usually hundreds of people show up and thousands of seeds and plants show up, and it's just like a nice big potluck of plants and seeds. So that's a good one. I see the Kilauea Neighborhood Association meeting is tonight. I'm going to go to that one. I don't have the agenda in front of me, but I did notice this is something that happened at the Planning Commission meeting. Charles Summers and his property there that was built and has blocked the access to the waterfall. This is something that will come up a little bit more, but it's a really excellent example of, like, how do we look at the structure of government? Because when there is a planning commission, these are volunteers, and they're actually doing a really good job, but most people do about a two-hour term of service. I mean, not two-hour, a two-year. And so when these homeowners that have just seemingly have bottomless wealth, they can hire the very best lawyers and just have them on retainer for 10 or 15 years, if that's what it takes, to just exhaust the institutional memory of the commission. And I happened to be at the Planning Commission last Tuesday when it came up, and really misinformation is straight up shared in the kindest of ways and given in an inch-thick document that's well-prepared. And the people sitting in there don't know the difference. So I'm going to go tonight to Kilauea Neighborhood Association and see what happened. And I did check. Two different intervener statuses were put forward, and they've both exhausted. You know, the community is literally putting money out to be able to fight these efforts. And it's hard, and it's exhausting, and it seems like maybe there's a hopefully not a win for them, but maybe it is.
And there is a workshop coming up on plasma energy, and we featured that on the show last week. It's two weekends, February 12th to 14th and February 19th to 21st. I happen to know that the first weekend is full. And if you'd like more information and to register, you can go to kauaiplasmaenergyworkshop.weebly.com. KauaiPlasmaEnergyWorkshop.Weebly.com.
I'm going to go to that one, too. And a lot of these that we know are because people have brought it to our attention. So if anybody wants their events or workshops brought to our attention, you can contact either KKCR.org. You can contact me directly, Felicia Longi Cowden, on Facebook. There's many different ways, and we always want to know what people have. Our guest next week is this Dr. Stephen Blake, who's a veterinarian. He is actually very active. Are you familiar with him, Jeffrey? I thought you were nodding your head. He is an activist on vaccinations for animals and where it creates problems. So he's coming from somewhere else, and then animal rights activist Sheila Young is going to be in here too. That's going to be the first half of next show, but they're having a workshop for pet care next Monday, the 8th, from 3:30 to 5:30, and that's up in the Kalihiwai Ridge area also. And on that same show, Syngenta Management is going to be coming in next week, and we'll be talking about the accident that happened with the chemical and the 10 people that were taken to the hospital for observation to see how that went.
And we also have another 24-hour basic training class for CERT, the Community Emergency Response Team, coming up at Hanalei School on Wednesdays at 5:30 to 9:30. And that'll be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 consecutive Wednesdays. And at the end of that, you'll be trained to join your local community response team community emergency response team to help out.
That's like if there's a hurricane or a big flood or an earthquake or whatever. But yeah. It's actually a really great group, and it's, you know, when you become prepared for an emergency, you become prepared for less than an emergency too. So that's an excellent thing. So we've got all kinds of really good things, and I think I just have, well, I've got two more to share. One is the National Tropical Hawaii Tropical Fruit Growers Association. We are doing an annual event here, and this is going to be really great. I'm looking at Christopher right now because I know his specialty is on avocados for this one, but I think they'll do ulu and lots of other fruit, and it's hosted on different islands different years, and so this year it's going to be on Kauai, and people will be coming from Japan and all over, and you know, we'll be looking for ways that we can possibly be exporting some of our crops. And it happens that they're interested in avocados. They might be interested in more. But Scott Sloan is the president of that, and there's many ways to... That's coming up. It'll be in late September, so it's a ways out. But we're in the planning stages now.
So there's a talk by Dr. Robin Baird on dolphins and whales on February 11th at 6:30 at the Hanapepe Library.
Okay, and that one is about the effect of sonar on it and sound, and that was actually sent to me by the military, showing, because we've had people from the base on the past couple times in the past month or so, and you know they're hoping that people go and look, because that is part of what that is. It doesn't look like they brought them here, but it is a piece of it. And my last thing is the county council this week is going to be on Thursday, and they're going to be looking at the county manager system. And so same time, like 8:30 to 9 o'clock, and it's a good time for people to come and look at that.
Just wanted to mention that the next Kauai Farmers Union meeting is on February 10th, next Wednesday, and it's every second Wednesday. And it's at 6 o'clock at the Anahola Clubhouse, and it starts with a local board potluck. You don't have to be a member of the Kauai Farmers Union to attend. You don't even have to be a farmer. It's very informative every time.
Yes, it's definitely fun.
Great place to meet good people.
And we might be hearing from a group. I'm kind of expecting a call in from them. We'll hear a little bit more, but... It's called A Night to Shine, and it is a prom that is for special needs people, and football player Tim Tebow Foundation is what puts that on, and that is going to happen on, I'm trying to look at that. I'll look in a moment. Sorry for that one. Should be a really good dance. This is a special needs prom, and hopefully they'll call me in a minute. I'll see what... time missing that. So we might be hearing from them any minute now. Otherwise, I want to start moving on to talking about what is effective farming at a small scale level. And Christopher came by my house the other day, kind of helping me do some harvesting of some different foods that are in my yard. And you had really great mana'o to share on that. And What is working for you? Like you are a small farm manager.
I'm in a really lucky situation where the landowners of the place I take care of, 30 years ago, they had the foresight to plant a lot of fruit trees. And over the last 30 years, they've kind of been picking and choosing what kind of crops they want to focus on. And like you mentioned earlier, kind of avocados is the thing that is our main thing. We have them most of the year round. And I'd say the biggest thing, after having that foresight to plant fruit trees and take care of them in a good way, is really being, I'm finding having good connections in the community. More than anything, having good relationships with restaurants, restaurant owners, and, the grocery stores, smaller health food stores, and things like that. Has made it really easy to keep productivity consistent. And I think one of the things that they're looking for, or that buyers are looking for, is consistency from the producer's side of things as well. So that's been my experience, you know, having a really nice consistent demand with consistent supply, and it's been working out really well.
How do you distribute to these places?
I distribute, you know, I just make regular deliveries. It's pretty much more than a regular thing at a certain day, a certain time. It's more along the lines of, you know, people will let me know when they're ready for an order and then just bring it on demand.
So you guys mostly grow avocados, correct?
Avocados, macadamia nuts, a lot of other things. I'd say avocados is our most consistent year-round crop.
And your customer is largely stores, small stores, and restaurants?
Yeah, the health food stores, as well as a few small restaurants as well.
Okay, great. We have our caller in about the prom. Hello, you're on the air. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Anna, and I am here to talk about prom. Our prom is going to be hosted by Lihue Missionary Church, and the title of the prom is Night to Shine, and this prom is for people with special needs. It's sponsored by Tim Tebow Foundation. Tim Tebow is a famous football player, I guess the last, I think one of the teams that he played for was Broncos. I'm not a football fan, but I've heard great things about
him. Colorado, right?
Part. Yeah, and so about the prom, it's going to be on Friday, February 12th, and that's going to be at the Kauai Marriott. It's by invitation only, and if anyone is interested, we do have a Facebook page that you can log in, and it's with Able Ministries.
A-B-L-E, Able Ministries?
Yes, Able Ministries. And this prom is the Night to Shine is an unforgettable prom night experience, and our mission and their mission is to bring faith, hope, and love to those with special needs. The ages are for people with special needs ages 16 and older, and this is actually a worldwide movement that it's already taken place in about 41 states across the nation and 7 countries around the world, and it's probably going to keep growing. Every guest in this prom, they're going to receive the red carpet experience, welcoming with friendly paparazzi. We're going to be giving them a VIP treatment. It starts actually with volunteers doing hair and makeup. We have some volunteers that already have been signed up for that. There's going to be shoe shining, station for shoe shining. We have volunteers that are going to make corsages and boutonnieres. I've even had people that have donated dresses for the girls, and there's going to be lots of dancing. And the highlight of the night will come when everyone of the Night to Shine guests is crowned as a king and queen of the prom. So just wanted to share that with you, and I just really appreciate you giving me time to
yes.
do that today.
Have you guys had one before?
Yes, we have had it for the last, 3 years. It was under a different organization, and so it keeps growing each year. So we started it 2011, I believe, but each year it keeps getting bigger and bigger, and we are reaching out more people in the community with special needs.
And typically how many people are there?
Well, let's see. With volunteers, it's going to be like about 200 people.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds really wonderful.
So I just wanted to thank you for giving me an opportunity to share about this wonderful experience that's about to happen. So, again, if you want any information, you can go ahead and log in on Able Ministries at Facebook.
And what if somebody doesn't have a computer? Is there a phone number that they could call?
Yes, you can talk to Matt Phillips. His number is 639-5833.
So that's Matt Phillips at 639-5833. And this
Correct.
Is with Able Ministries. And so this prom for special needs, those are teenage up through adult. So any age is welcome, and it's a place where people come and really get cherished for the evening.
Yes, that's correct, and ages 16 and older.
And where is it at?
It's going to be at the Kauai Marriott.
Okay, so in the Lihue area.
Yes, it is in Lihue, the Lihue Kauai Marriott.
Okay, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you so much. Okay, have a great evening.
Okay, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
Okay, so that's a nice thing. Definitely a nice thing. So we're kind of back to talking about agriculture a little bit, Christopher, here. So in the example that you guys have is that I consider that successful small agriculture. Can you give us, like, poundage of what maybe you harvest every year? And, I mean, is there a short window? Do you have all the same kinds of avocado trees, or do you have a whole bunch of different types? So it's...
With the avocados, yeah, we have a lot of different varieties. You know, a lot of times they'll skip a year in production. So, yeah, lots of different varieties. I'd say probably a dozen different varieties. And we're really trying to nail it so they're just happening all year round, all the time. Last year there was about 2 months that they weren't in production, but the year before it was, you know, even less than that. And hopefully this year it'll be even less than that. So,
Or even more than that, there is active production.
Yeah, exactly.
So the goal is 12 months a year. Mm. And then you represent, I know, one farm for sure, but then you help some of the other neighbor farms on the same road?
Yeah, totally. Have a little, you know, HUI system and just try to help everybody help everybody.
Because that's something that I know the Kauai Farmers Union is looking to do, and a number of these small farms are knowing that they need to do, is work to have these cooperatives. So a success in the small farm area is that there are a number of ag parcels that were planted and grown about 20 to 30 years ago, and they're actually really in heavy production. And I think the low-hanging fruit, every pun intended, for the state and the county is that we really can be counting and making more of an awareness and distribution of the foods that are actually on the trees. There are many farms that seem like they have trouble with getting the distribution out. Now, I think Marshall was mentioning it. Your background, you, like, studied this, right? You actually went to school for agriculture, too?
Yeah, I actually, recently I just completed the Go Farm program, Go Farm Hawaii, here in Kauai, and that was last summer. It was an amazing experience. Then I also just finished my BA.
Bachelor of Arts.
Yeah, and I focused that on sustainability and community development. And I did a senior project focused on the local food movement in Hawaii, specifically on Kauai. Out of that, I brought all of my findings together on a website that's eatlocalkauai.com.
Eatlocalkauai.com.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I just looked at it before we came on, and for some reason it's not up at the moment, but it should be, so hopefully that'll be fixed, you know. Maybe it's fixed now, hopefully by tomorrow.
And you are a part of the Kauai Farmers Union.
I'm not officially a member.
Okay, gotta try.
But yeah, I'm an occasional visitor there.
Yeah, because I see you there.
Yeah. So one of the things that I find that is being successful is there is a growing demand for local foods, and there's a big hype, you know, created by the state, by the county, of, you know, really creating a demand and a trend for local production. And so it's kind of the thing that needs to happen is getting the overabundance that you're speaking of, you know, the low-hanging fruit and maybe the farms or people's estate properties that the food's just going to the chickens. How do we get that to the markets, to the stores, to the restaurants? How do we get that food to the people as well?
And even to the food pantries.
Absolutely, yeah.
I did go to the last Go Farm meeting last week, and Earl Kashiwagi was there from Asaki's Produce, and he's always very entertaining to listen to, and he's got lots of really raw perspective. He's pretty funny of what works, what doesn't, and how, you know, we're able to be developing these markets. That was good. And also the woman farmer that BASF brought that was here all last week, her name is Melissa, and I know I was a little like resistive. I'm going, great, you know, we have Big Ag bringing, you know, kind of small ag to, you know, be their face of what's there. But she was really good. She spoke well, and what was interesting for me, she was from Pittsburgh, and she has some success at what she's doing. But I was seeing from her stories almost the very same thing that happens over here for food production, where she has six interns who are paid but a very mere stipend, and then 50 hours a week, and then get housing. And it seems to be what is the requirement to have food and food production. And she had leased lands, and she was, you could tell, a very hard worker, intelligent woman, and if not certified organic, growing with natural farming methods. So sometimes people can't get through that whole hump of getting the certification for organics because it's expensive. But, you know, she was saying, you know, I wish I could buy the land, but I can't buy the land. It's so expensive. It's between, I mean, it can be as cheap as $2,000 an acre, but sometimes it's up to $7,000. And that actually is expensive to be buying land, but like here, you know, it's $200,000 an acre maybe, or, you know, it's just, it's so out of reach. And so what I really got from her is hard work was necessary, a really good relationship with the stores and the venues for selling it. She did a consumer-supported agriculture, so she had organized clients. So she did a lot of things right, and still yet, she has interns rather than paid workers and can't afford the land that she's sitting on. So it is a profound problem across the country. It's not just here, it's everywhere. And we have so much legislation that doesn't really fit the small farmer. So it's a workout. I went to the Food Safety Modernization Act training that the College of Tropical Agriculture and Human Resources put on, and they did a good job, except I don't think that they really understood the bill that well, or not the bill, the legislation. We learned about good agricultural practices. And, you know, I couldn't tell if she didn't know or she did know, but there's something called the Tester Amendment in there. I mean, mostly it makes natural farming illegal. Toddlers aren't able to be there. A bird can't fly over your farm. You can't have dogs and cats. It doesn't really say, well, what do you do with the rats, right? A toddler is considered in the same area as the pets. You know, you can violate your clearance in so many different ways, like if you have a six-year-old or a 60-year-old boy or any kind of unpotty-trained man who pees in the bushes on your farm, there it goes. You know, you lose your whole piece. And I think that, you know, I think common sense tells you it doesn't really hurt anything if somebody pees in the bushes, right? But, I mean, it's just those things that are so natural and native, not to girls, but to guys. that's the thing. I just think, oh, my goodness, you know, when I see what you can't do, there's a lot of good agricultural practices that are in there, but violating that is a felony. It's not just, oh, you get a fine or you get a problem. You go to criminal court for making small mistakes. So there is a whole lot that is difficult in there. And then we have a slew of right to farm bills that are in front of the legislature again, which is, did you pay attention to these things, Christopher?
Not so much. I mean, I keep an ear open and an eye open, but no, I don't really follow the legislature so much.
You're seeing me sigh. And you're such a good example of a great farmer. And I will tell you, you need to pay attention. Everybody needs to pay attention. There's a very small handful of us who are being really, really diligent at watching what comes up. And it's not that the people writing it, you know, have an ill intention. They are looking at it to protect a certain type of farmer. And it's not the type of farmer that you are. And so that's why I'm looking at this whole show today about democracy taking a lot of work. If we don't actually participate, somebody had said, I liked it, they said, if you're not at the table, you're likely on the menu. And so there are very big pieces that we need to be looking at in that. And one of them that's in front of me is House Bill 849. But there are about six or seven different ways. So people fight one, or they adapt it, or they change it, but then they got to go to the next and the next and the next. We have a caller. Aloha. Thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Felicia. Yeah, this is a real interesting topic here. I think I remember when Dr. Evelyn was here that he made mention that the use of Roundup and these other chemical farming techniques actually defeats the soil to be able to defend itself against the contaminations that we're talking about here right now. And that may be some of the reason why they're wanting to change this Food Modernization Act. Because people who had farm animals on their farms with their vegetables for since ever there's been farmers and animals.
Well, nature would be a felon. For sure. I think this is designed to really facilitate very big agriculture that uses chemicals. But my guess is this legislation is really written in an office by people who aren't farming. And I think it's hard on everybody. And something that I was really concerned with is this was done independent of the development of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And for those who have forgotten, the Trans-Pacific Partnership says international companies are not to be held liable to municipal, state, or national laws anywhere. So when we hold farmers locally liable to a very heavy degree, and then somebody can farm it in Colombia or Ecuador or Malaysia or the Netherlands or wherever else without these same requirements, it sort of defeats itself. It really works hard against what we have.
I see. I just wanted to bring that point up. I just took off driving. I better get off the phone.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Christopher, I wanted to ask you about the experiment you did in eating local foods.
Yeah, so is part of my senior project that I just completed this last year. I did an experiment of 30 days eating 100% locally grown foods. I gave myself a little bit of cushion to include all of the Hawaiian islands. And on my webpage that I mentioned earlier, Eat Local Kauai, I tracked my experience through a blog, kind of looking at the challenges that I encountered and, you know, some of the blessings and the curses of eating local now. And I kind of directed my diet towards convenience more than anything. I think a lot of our culture's diets, our westernized culture diet, are kind of geared towards convenience and busy lifestyles. So I kind of kept that direction. And it was interesting, you know, I might have suffered a little bit in a couple of nutritional areas. But at the same time, I was feeling great. I was feeling light. And I tracked how much time it was taking me, how much money it was costing me, things like that. I even did nutritional analysis through University of California. And so really just tracking all the little pieces I could think of to track and compare it to 30 days of just tracking my regular diet.
What were the nutritional aspects that you found lacking in yourself at the end of this?
For me, it was mostly in the trace minerals department. And I think that was maybe from the lack of a wide variety of foods that I was eating. I kind of found a few, you know, half a dozen staple, easy go-to things, that worked with my lifestyle at the time and, didn't diversify as much as I think I usually do with the different varieties of foods and things that I'm eating. And again, if that was my intent to focus on the nutritional aspect, I think I could do it. But I was mostly focusing on convenience.
Right. Did you eat any seaweed?
I was not eating any seaweed. No local seaweed.
That might have helped with the trace minerals.
Yeah, I'm sure it would have.
That might have helped. So the neighborhood that you're in, it seems like lots of people there all up and down the street in that whole area. I see quite a lot of serious ag production in it. Is that consistent with your observation?
Not necessarily. It seems, I'd call it more hobbyist farmers, it seems like. You know, small orchards, small gardens. There's, you know, a couple places where there's more production-oriented endeavors, but for the most part, it seems like a lot of the North Shore neighborhoods that I've seen that are, you know, technically ag land are not necessarily going in that agricultural production direction for whatever reason, you know, whether it's tax breaks or whatever, that people are able to find loopholes and purchase ag land and then develop them more as estate properties.
The reason I was asking is that, like, a lot of times I'm defending the small agriculture parcel and saying there's quite a bit of food on it, because I know that I do go around and I do see quite a bit of food, oftentimes not harvested, so that can be problematic. People do bring it to the food pantries and things, but I did get called out on that, so I went, I think it was yesterday, and looked at a subdivision called Aliamanu Estates, just north of Anahola. And, you know, I was seeing some of the drama that was happening there. And I'm bringing this up in context of, like, we call out, or on this station anyway, and sometimes on this show, a lot of the things that we don't appreciate about big agriculture. And I will often be defending small agriculture because I'm aware of the different small agriculture people that have things working. But when I went to Aliamanu Estates, I saw where the impact of the neighborhood association, they set these covenants and conditions and restrictions such that it almost makes it illegal to farm in this agricultural subdivision. And the people way up the hill, they're very committed to having an ocean view all the way down the hill. And some things of what we're really having experience of across the island is big money can fight little money very effectively. And so when we have, you know, in that case, like, people go, well, I can't quite see the ocean because I can see your trees. But in reality, those trees are even on a hill, and they're not going to see the ocean even if the trees are cut down. But people are having, then one property there, they had to cut down over 100 mango trees and 20 coconut trees, and there's another area where there's...
That's just painful.
It's really painful, and I saw where a big stand of mangoes and avocados and, you know, very productive area had been pruned to the point of being butchered, and they're still producing, but it probably cut those trees in half their life, and it is, that does live out the stereotype of some of these communities where you're not even allowed to farm. You're not even allowed to farm, and it's mostly just grassland, and you're not even really seeing sheep or goats or elements like that that are a part of it. So that is a big part of these issues that we need to be looking at, and pulling in some of these meetings that I went to. When I went to the Charter Review Commission meeting week before last, that's the fourth Saturday of every month, and this next one is really important. It's very hard to get people to go in there. There are good people that are volunteers that are in there, but they have an incredible amount of power, and maybe they don't even realize it, but, like, the Planning Commissioner came before the Charter Review Commission meeting and asked for, and probably really needed it, asked for a new commission. That would be the Zoning Commission, to be looking and taking the time to sit there and get in the middle of all these little battles. And he suggested that maybe those commissioners should be paid because it's a thankless task. It's hard to get people to come in to do it. And those are the types of things that, like, if we put that on the charter amendment for the ballot, it could really grossly expand the cost of government for Kauai. So it's a big deal. And when we're looking at that, You know, it begs a lot of questions. I have Bridget in here now, and Bridget was in there for that discussion of when we add more in the Planning Commission to have the zoning group. And she's getting hooked up here very quickly, and we're going to be hearing from her about what she might be thinking about the decisions to make in that kind of direction. Because there are many zoning issues, and we have extreme wealth living here, and oftentimes it's just at an investment level. And then when people are investing at that level, the county does well on that because these people pay an incredible amount of taxes. It's taxation without representation. They don't vote. So they do sometimes, they might feel like get taken to the cleaners. But it then creates a county that needs to work towards that much more. So, Bridget.
Yes, Misha.
Let me make sure that you are mic'd up right. So, thank you for coming in. And what was your read on wanting to have a separate zoning commission?
Well, they were talking about having a community-based or layperson, members of the public, on a five-member zoning appeals board, as opposed to having a contested case hearing heard by a hearing officer or an administrative law judge, which is somebody that's got a legal license and is trained in zoning laws and zoning issues. And my sense was that it would be difficult for, you know, average citizens who are hardworking people, but to come up on the law and make appropriate decisions when there's a contested case hearing and somebody is objecting to either the county's denial of a permit or somebody that's adversely impacted is maybe going to have a contested case hearing about the granting of a permit where they don't feel it's gone through the proper administrative scrutiny. In either case, it's going to be difficult for, you know, just your regular folk who've never practiced law or read statutes or been involved in understanding concepts like the different types of zoning to take that role on.
And the big challenges certainly are the small person and, you know, whether they can have a windbreak or trees and things like that. But we also, like this week, we had the urgent care clinic come up under discussion at the Planning Commission. They're looking at putting something here very close to where we are in Princeville between Foodland and the affordable housing. That's the new area right there. Other things, I'm just going to ask you because I know this is an area of your strength. You are part of the Friends of Mahalapu.
Yes, I am.
And so we see a contaminated river right there. We see it for months and months and months. So actually, as long as we've been looking, the numbers are like 8,000 times higher than what is considered healthy. They're very high.
They are.
Very high. And I get information come to me from different citizens. They show me where the sludge is put out there in the Grove Farm property from the water treatment plants. I asked you about that. You said maybe you thought that it wasn't that. I know you're with a group who are really looking at the water contaminations.
We are.
So what do you think it is? And I know you're speculating right here, but I'm looking for what direction to take, because as I've called the Board of Water, or excuse me, the Department of Health and these different groups, I simply don't get a call back.
Well, if I can give you a little history, Felicia, when citizens of the South Shore became concerned about the plan to add 2,000 dairy cows to Mahalapu Valley, our concern was for the contamination of stream water, groundwater, the ocean, and we learned our only source of drinking water for all of Poipu came from three county wells that was right at Mahalapu. So we really started to take a look at it and say, what happens when they're planning a land-based application? They're not going to take the waste away. They're not going to remove the manure. They're not going to methane digest it. It's all going on the property, and the property it's going on is 517 acres for 2,000 cows. So that's over, you know, 4 cows per acre. So it's really concentrated. And Surfrider, we kind of partnered with them and said, how will we know? How can we tell contamination is happening and maybe get on top of it early so we don't lose our wells because once nitrates, and that's the big thing manure has, nitrates. Nitrates get into drinking water. Once they've passed federal standards and they've raised above, you don't clean them out. They're very expensive to get out of water. You have to use a process called reverse osmolarity. And Surfrider has been testing the water all over the island in a partnership agreement with Department of Health. They've actually had a contract with Department of Health. And they've been doing that for a while. And it's part of their Blue Water Task Force. That's what the operation is called. They hadn't tested the fresh water at Waiopili because there wasn't really any development there, so nobody expected to find particular contamination. So Carl Berg, Dr. Berg, said to us, well, let me get some baseline testing done. And that was last March of 2014, actually almost 2 years ago now. And he said, let me get baseline testing, and then we'll kind of have a groundwork to go by, and we'll watch carefully. We test every month all over the island, and if it becomes necessary, we can test more often, and we send all our results to Department of Health. So that sounded good. We said, yeah, great, do it. And so they did it, and Surfrider took on that expense and that task, and there's a lot of Surfrider people involved in the water sampling. They're trained. They know how to draw samples. And what they found early on was that the water was extremely contaminated in the Waiopili, and they went up, and because the state set that standard, Enterococcus, as their measurement, or they refer to it sometimes as coliform. But they set that standard because that tells them, they know if that bacteria is there, there's other bacteria there. In other words, when that one's present, there's always other bacteria colonies. But they test for that one, and they count it. So he got numbers about 8,000, 9,000, 10,000, as high as 17,000 bacteria colonies in just 3 ounces of fresh water. So he got a hold of Department of Health, and Surfrider prepared regular reports and sent it in. And so by July of 2014, the Department of Health came out themselves and drew samples. Their numbers were within 10% of the readings that Surfrider got. They were all very close.
And they were actually higher.
And some of them were higher, yes. So, and they went upstream and into the property site. And then Hawaii Dairy Farms decided they would get involved and run their own test, and they took it to a lab, and they got different numbers that were about 50%, but they were using a different standard. So I think people may remember Amy Hennessy actually had a piece in the paper about how they had to go back to their lab, and they had to change their standard. They had to change their method of calibration to try to make the numbers sense of them to see. But the bottom line was they found contamination well above acceptable state standards as well. So the issue is then, where is it coming from? And people proposed a lot of different things. We had been, as a group, Friends of Mahalapu had expressed concern to Department of Health about the amount of waste 2,000 cows or even the startup herd of 699 cows will produce. It will produce 699 cows are going to produce 100,000 pounds of wet manure a day, and they're going to produce over 7,000 gallons of urine a day. So that's a lot to be going on primarily clay soil. They're going to graze the herd in concentrated fashion. So they're going to be in small pods, all 700 cows on 24 acres or all 2,000 cows on 24 acres. So you get real concentrated application. And so we've been saying, we don't think this is good for the water. It's going to get in the ground. And they said back to us, well, we're taking a look at it. We want to see how much the grass might use. And we had horticulturalists tell us the grass can't use that much when it's fresh because it's not cured. It's inefficient. And so we said we had this whole dialogue with the state. And in October of 2014, all of a sudden it comes out that the state had issued 4 permits to wastewater treatment contractors. And they'd been dumping what they call biosolids, or treated human sewage sludge, on the soil, not near the Waiopili, kind of distant from it. But they'd had parcels that were leased from Grow Farm contracts. Grow Farm was allowing it. And there were wastewater treatment solids from as far away as Princeville coming in trucks and dumping in the Waiopili. And here we have this beautiful, pristine coastline, and none of us knew it. Nobody knew it.
And so these solids, like I had heard that perhaps that the state was going to pay for a a water test of the wells to see if it's getting, there's human indicators like caffeine and different medications. Is that correct? Do I have that correct?
Yeah, there's first, and the easiest thing they look for is what they call perfringes. And if they find a perfringe in the sample, then they treat it as a potential human cause. But there's certain animals like pigs and chickens that also have perfringes along with the Enterococcus. So how do you discern if it's people or if it's chickens and pigs, feral pigs? Well, that's difficult, and so you need some pretty sophisticated testing, and then you get into the next level where you look for human markers like vitamins, caffeine, Prozac, things that don't go away when wastewater treatment plants work to make, and this is treated. The biosolids from the humans are treated. Cow stuff's not going to be treated, but
right.
the human stuff was treated, and it was raked into the soil 6 inches down. That was the state protocol that they required on the permits given. But unbeknownst to us, while we're talking to the state about our concern, and Surf Riders Blue Water Task Force is reporting monthly, as they've done for the whole island, DOH is going, maybe we shouldn't have these wastewater
DOH
treatment
is,
plants.
Okay,
Department of Health. So they rethink the advisability of having those biosolids dumped in Mahalapu, because the stream is coming pretty coming out very contaminated. And where is it coming from? They don't know, because, like I say, there's quite a distance between the sludge pads that they were dumping in and raking in. There's quite a distance between them and the Waiopili. So how did they get there? Well, unfortunately, with a volcanic rock, which our island is, there's what they call a fractured rock formation. So water travels laterally, goes sideways, travels with the slope, the natural slope, which is down toward the beach, and it moves underground, and you don't know where stuff is going. So what they did was, somewhere in the end of the summer of 2014, the wastewater treatment branch, or the waste branch, a wastewater branch of the Department of Health, and their director, Sina Pruder, made the decision, you know what, we're not going to renew those contracts. Those companies are going to have to find a different place to dump their biosolids. So they started not non-renewing. When their permits came up, they just sent them letters saying, sorry, you're going to have to find a different location. We've gotten some test results that we don't know for sure if it's your contribution or what it is. So we need you to find another location.
So you are listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea. That is Bridget Hammerquist. And we are talking right now about what is going on in the Mahalapu area and where there is contamination in the stream. The larger context of this is about state legislation on right to farm. And we will be talking a little bit more in a moment after we hear from our underwriters if Bridget is following some of these state issues and that, like, how we can have something to do with it. We also have Jeffrey Jackson in the studio with us, who is in here more about the vaccination legislation, but does have some knowledge on water contamination in different areas, and in fact is from the Detroit, Michigan outer area. So he has done a lot of research in different areas on what is hard for people. So Kauai Soapbox is made possible by listeners like you in partnership with the Copper Man.
KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, K224CQ, Anahola, K284AL, Haleiwa.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
The Copper Man. Copper, stainless steel, and galvanized aluminum. We specialize in ornamental and custom work and fabricate and install any kind sheet metal work, residential and commercial. Serving Kauai for over 30 years. We're still talking. HarryConti.com. That's HarryConti.com. Or 639-3456.
Aloha, listeners of KKCR. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global news hour, urging you to support Kauai Community Radio. As a beacon of free speech, KKCR has been broadcasting from their jungle shack and building community in the island since 1997. KKCR brings you Hawaiian culture and music, independent voices and choices like Democracy Now!, otherwise shut out from the corporate media. During this program, please show your love for KKCR by making an investment in the station that loves you and become a sustaining member. Your monthly support at any level will pay dividends all year long and ensure the continued success of Kauai Community Radio. From our family at Democracy Now! To your ohana in the center of the Pacific, mahalo for your support. It really does make a difference.
Yes, and mahalo for supporting Kauai Community Radio, and it truly does make a difference, especially as I'm sitting in this room that's under some work, and we're able to see that volunteers are working hard to get fresh carpet and fresh soundproofing and all kinds of things that help us.
Here in our jungle shack.
Here in our jungle shack, that's right. So, okay, so, Bridget. I appreciate how well and how deeply you are able to articulate what are the challenges that are going on. And so we have a problem with the water even without a dairy there. And it's not that people don't like dairies for the most part. People are just concerned that it's on this muddy water, I mean this muddy clay, and it's going to be running down. And when you all check to see, well, let's get a baseline, and I think the expectation is you're going to see pretty pristine water. They put the animals in, and oh my gosh, you got a problem. But they hadn't even put the animals in. You put this test in, and already there's a problem. So it could be this human biosludge. Are there any other animals in the area that it could be? There's a horse ranch a little bit further out. Doesn't seem like that would be enough to create that kind of problem.
No, I don't think the horse ranch is close enough at all, or geographically in the right area to affect the area that the water was sampled from. And I should add, Felicia, that once the bad water was found, or the contaminated water was found, it was tested more regularly than once a month. I mean, there were two fellows that actually worked on it and tested it weekly for over 10 weeks and got the same numbers consistently. And we've been getting the reports from Surfrider, and right through this month, they are still in the 8,000 plus range, which is astronomical for any body of fresh water. I mean, there's nowhere on the island where there's any kind of contamination like that.
And do they test it like in front of, I won't even name the names because I don't want to hurt the hotels that are right around from that, but that comes out and it's one of the highest trafficked areas of our visitors. It's just right around the corner. Does the water get tested in the ocean?
Yes, it does. And the water in front of the resorts and the residences has not been a problem, not been contaminated.
Okay.
So it's really over in Mahalapu, and it's really seems to be the Waiopili stream and where it comes into the beach and the beach pool that kids kind of lay around and loll in because it's warmish as it enters the ocean. That's been very, very contaminated. And sometimes you can actually see gray sort of bubbling on it. I mean, it doesn't look good. I know I said to Dr. Berg, well, okay, there's a few cows in the valley, maybe 40 to 50. There's some kind of shiro farm pigs. There's some, not pigs, I'm sorry, sheep. They have sheep there, and they have some goats in there. And there's wild chickens, not a lot, but they're there. And then we have the migratory birds, the nene goose. We have the kloa duck. We have the shearwaters.
So there's different animals up there.
There's different animals.
But it doesn't seem like it's such a level that it would have this high of a contamination. We don't know.
We don't know, but we would think that if it were just due to the feral animals and the few animals that are there now, there'd be other areas on the island where there's that kind of population that would test out like this.
Well, I do notice that this issue, for as profound as it is, it's not making the main press. Or have you seen it? I haven't.
It did get a low coverage at the end of 2014. The Garden Island actually carried about three or four articles about it, and the paper seemed, when Christy Angelo was our environmental reporter, I know it got his attention. He was very concerned about it. But the, the bottom line is it's still there, and the even more important thing from our perspective that I said to Dr. Berg, what does it mean? And he says, well, it means you certainly don't want to put a herd of anything in there. because it's already so bad.
So this right to farm elements, you know, when I look at the wording of the right to farm, I don't know if you have looked at this bill, the current one.
I have.
You have. Okay. And you've seen that there's a handful of them, right? So a lot of times multiple bills will be put in. Usually there's a House bill and a Senate bill, and there's several different ones. So sometimes if we're not diligent, you think, okay, you controlled one, but there's one right behind it that follows through on it. So we'll have to be really looking at that. Now, Bridget, I really respect the fact that you have a law background and a health background, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, she's a smart girl, everybody. That's a really important thing. I wanna bring Jeffrey into the discussion a little bit, because we're going to be hitting many topics, and among them is... It might be a good way to segue somewhat with water in other areas. Looks like we have a caller. We can take a call, but I want to see if you have followed much of different water challenges. And why I want to talk about the water challenges is it does come with infectious diseases, which often flows with vaccinations and the need for them. Being that you're a nurse, Bridget, I would guess, but I don't know because I've never talked to you about this, that you're probably... more in favor of vaccines. I know that Marshall and I have, you know, he's more conservative than I am. I appreciate vaccines, but I don't think they should be mandatory. To me, it's the removal of a civil right and a human right. I'm going to let Jeffrey weigh in here. You've been quiet so far.
Oh, the guests have been amazing. I don't want to cut into their time. Well, I can add, I'm from, like you said, I'm from Metro Detroit, and currently we have a water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and in fact, it's such a bad water crisis that it's declared a federal state of emergency. So when I heard Bridget talk about this, I think, well, is this a canary in a coal mine? Is this the first step? And what kind of contamination? Are people being tested? Are the places where kids play, is there a sign there with a warning so kids know when they go home and their parents, if they get sick, they know maybe what's going on, and more importantly, how to treat it and get on top of it.
Right.
Because we now have a precedent that's been set in Flint, and unfortunately, if the officials in Flint did not do the right thing, and they went towards not publicizing, and they also went towards following money and contracts instead of the rights of the people. And what happened, and this is sad to say, is we have children with lead poisoning now, and not just little lead poisoning. We're talking thousands of percents of lead poisoning. These kids are now, they'll be handicapped in some way for the rest of their life. So when I hear what Bridget's talking about, my question is, what have we learned? Where can we go from here, and how can we get in front of this?
Well, I know that we have one of our members of Friends of Malibu was a EPA executive for 30 years.
And Environmental Protection Agency.
Right, and she was a director in the state of Washington. And I've heard her say that the EPA failed the people there, just as the EPA has failed the people in Michigan. And I actually heard her advise one of the governor's aides not to fail the people in Hawaii. And they do need to get on top of this, and Jeffrey's right. This is a little bit of the canary in the coal mine. We're getting a warning. We're getting a real strong warning. And it's good that you brought up the issue of warning signs, because Friends of Mahalapu has donors, fortunately. That's how we exist. And we volunteered to cover the cost of the warning signs. And they were made to state standards exactly. They're just like the warning signs the state has posted down at the Hanalei River in Hanalei, to warn people that river is at times quite contaminated. So just as Jeff said, they'll have a clue if their kids get sick. We have quite a few volunteers in Friends of Mahalapu that have taken it upon themselves. Every time they're in Mahalapu, if they notice children playing, they go up to the parents and they say, you know, when you get out of here, get them washed off right away, because that is a seriously contaminated body of water. Don't let them get it in their mouth. Don't let them get it in their eyes. And if you got bottled water, pour it on their hands right now and, you know, get them washed right away, or take them out into the ocean far enough out to where they get really cleaned up.
And the state doesn't put signs up?
No. And the one comment we had from the state was from Watson Okubo, who's the investigative officer with the Clean Water Branch. And he made the comment to the Garden Island, and they quoted him as saying that he didn't want it to appear that the state was helping the Hyatt in their lawsuit against the proposed farm that's going to go in 1.7 miles from the Hyatt and really threatens the Hyatt's business. And we thought that was pretty absurd, and Surfrider challenged him. Surfrider actually filed a formal complaint with the Department of Health objecting to their failure to post the stream because, you know, it's not like you want them to post every body of water that just, you know, has occasional rise above state standards. This is something that has astronomical rise above state standards.
Chronically.
Chronically. Every single month. It's never come even close, Felicia, to state standards. I mean, it's thousands of bacteria colonies above. In fact, the state, to give you an idea, the state laboratory tests for the bacteria colonies, and their readings go to 2005. That's their top number that they count, because as far as they're concerned, if it hits 2005, it's off the Richter scale. They don't even bother to count beyond 2005. So what you'll see on the state, if you go on the state site and you look at what kind of numbers they've gotten, you'll see that little caret that means greater than 2005. And that's the way they report the bacteria. But if you go to the state and say, but did you ever run to see what it was beyond? They did.
And they see that it is four or five times that amount.
They got numbers like 17,000 and 12,000 when they actually had a lab that was more detailed do the sophisticated breakdown. They found a lot more bacteria colonies per 100 cc's of water.
Now I see Marshall looks ready. Did a caller have a comment?
I want to encourage the caller that we just lost to call back, because I'd like you to have an opportunity to ask your question.
Oh, okay. So caller, call back. So we're hearing that, and then kind of pulling it back a little bit. Well, I want to just broaden it out as I see all these people from the island of Hawaii that are listening. You know, these challenges that we're talking about, they don't just sit here in Kauai. Everywhere, you know, Oregon's having problems. All kinds of problems are happening. But what we've seen also on Hawaii Island, consistent with what the Mauna Kea protectors have been saying, at least that I've heard this whole time, is that those mountains are filled with water. They're, you know, they're filled all the way up. And then, so, like, the UH has announced that there's been a surprise amount of fresh water. This is, you know, maybe close to a year ago, but they discovered that, hey, the water table there is 4,500 feet. And this is right under where they're doing all this ordnance testing. They get depleted uranium. It gets in there. We see how Red Hill on Oahu has contaminants in the water. And it seems like when we have issues like this, we're not getting enough legislation. And it takes citizens to be asking for that legislation. Have you asked for any specific legislation on water quality?
Well, we've asked them to post the stream, for sure.
But I mean for legislation, like how do we... Because when we
The legislation is there, Felicia. They set the standards. The state set the standards. And, you know, they just said, well, we're just not going to post. But if you look at the standards they set, they should be posting based on their own standards and their own written protocols. So they're just not following their own protocols.
They're just not following their own protocols. Okay, we have a caller. Aloha, you're on the air.
Hi there, this is Tammy.
Hi, Tammy.
Tammy.
Hi. I wanted to, just because we're talking about water issues and the runoff and the E. coli and all the contaminants that are in the runoff, that one of the main solutions that I see in the field of remediation is going to be the using mushrooms and wood chips to clean up these anywhere there's water running off into a body of water. It's been shown that these mushroom filters can help clean up E. coli as well as possibly break down things like atrazine and other pesticides.
So is that mostly effective at the surface level, that and, say, biochar? I mean, if it's getting down into the wells, is there a way that that helps that?
Well, I think that you'd have to figure out how to place the filter between the source of contamination before it sinks. Because if the water's flowing across the land and then sinking in, you can catch it where it's flowing across. If it's obvious where the water is actually going down into the water table, that would be the best place to put these, you know, because it needs to be like a some sort of wood chip filter that you would inoculate. And also, you know, the IMO, the indigenous microorganisms, the Korean farming methods, where if you're going to do animal husbandry and you really want to make sure you're using the microbes to inoculate any of your bedding so that a lot of that stuff gets treated on site.
Yes, I think that's great. Have you sent anything to the Department of Public Works for Kauai or even to Grow Farm? I would really like to have where Public Works is important is where we do these transfer stations, I think, using mycelium and microbes and biochar. There's probably big pads that we could put that would help to mop up what's draining out of there and to help it a bit. We really need to help our county and help our state figure out how to do this stuff if it isn't evident to them.
Right, and it is a new science, so I think it's under experimentation. We would need funding to be able to do the experiments that would prove, you know, what scale it can be effective at. And I know it's been done in Oregon and up in Washington and other places, so I'll just keep
Well, let's make an effort, and I will help you to invite them. I'm going to be going to your class this weekend, but, you know, we need to be helping them, so.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we'll just keep spreading the word.
Okay, thank you.
Mycelial Network. Thank you.
All right. Aloha.
Felicia, if I might add, I think one of the difficulties in the case of, like, an animal feed operation where there's a land application of all the waste over 517 acres is it's just too big an area. And part of that soil is clay-based, so there's runoff.
Yep.
Part of the soil is well-draining. And, in fact, they chose an 81-acre pad to desludge the effluent ponds that they collect from just washing the milking parlor. And they say that's only going to be about 10% of the total waste. But that's all going to get pumped down onto this 81-acre pad, which they call a manure and sludge pad, because it'll have manure from the cows and then the extra sludge from the...
81 acres. Sludge pad? That's
right.
A big sludge pad.
They have two of them, two 80-acre sludge pads. But the 81-acre sludge pad that Friends of Mahalapu is most concerned about is within 700 feet of the two county wells.
Yes, I've seen that on the drawing. How big is a football field? Do you know how many acres is a football field, anybody? I don't know. Okay, we're going to have to figure
three,
that out.
Three.
I would think three or four.
It is about three.
So
yeah, we did look it up earlier to make a comparison.
Okay, because I'm just trying to think of a comparison, because 81 acres, that's, you know, 30, maybe less than 30, 20-something football
fields. About 26
fields.
Football fields. And the difficulty is that the modality that she was just talking about, you know, becomes impractical when you're not dealing with a point source discharge, but you're dealing with broad-based discharge and voluminous broad-based discharge.
So the best choice is to avoid having the problem in the first place.
You don't put it near drinking water usually. I mean, that's really every state that's had that happen is having big problems. Like Jeff said, people can go on the internet and put nitrate, water, and pollution, and they'll pull up all kinds of locations. Kewaunee, Wisconsin, they can't drink their water. There's places in New Mexico, places in Idaho, places in Des Moines, Iowa, city of 504,000 people, lost all of their well water. And their city, Des Moines, Iowa, 500,000 people, their city fathers filed a lawsuit, $100 billion lawsuit, to pay for the reverse osmolarity plant that they're having to put in.
How much?
$100
billion. $100 billion.
Yeah.
Where did they get that?
Well, where does the animal agriculture operation get it? I don't know. I don't know if they're insured. I don't know how that's going to work. I do know
that we don't have that.
No.
I can
no.
tell you that. Kauai doesn't have
not
that.
Not even close. Not even close. And when I was talking
I don't even think the owner of the dairy farm has that, and he's a wealthy man.
Yes, he is. An environmental engineer in King County asked me how deep was the pocket of the owner of this proposed operation? And I said, well, he's reportedly an $8 billion man. He said, not enough. So, I mean, it's real serious stuff. And if big cities like Des Moines, Iowa, and I met an Iowan who's here visiting on island right now, and he totally confirmed all this stuff that that I was reading on the internet. If they can be, you know, persuaded by big money and big ag that this is going to be safe, it'll be okay, nobody will get hurt. And, you know, when people have a lot of money, government officials tend to think they've got the resources. They're going to hire the best. They're going to do it right. But the reality is that the people that are proposing the dairy farm for Kauai have never had a dairy farm in their life. The man that they've named for their manager, Jim Garmitz, describes himself as a dairy herdsman. And he was a herdsman back in New Mexico, in Buena Vista, New Mexico. He wasn't anybody who designed a dairy farm or who's ever run a dairy farm. And Kyle Dada, who's the manager of Olupono, he's never run a dairy farm. And so they're proposing to do this thing. They think it'll work. They think it'll be good. And as one of our members said directly to Pam Omidyar, you're doing it. She called it their test dairy. She said, if it works at Malapu, we're going to put 5 more in the state of Hawaii. That's our goal. We want to have over 10,000 cows, and then we think Hawaii can be independent in its milk needs.
So I can commend the idea of having that milk sustainability, but that seems like a high risk.
Ah, but there's a word you used in there, Felicia, sustainability, and they use it as well. But if you look up sustainability requires that it's environmentally friendly, eco-integrity, they call it. In other words, it doesn't deplete the environmental resources, doesn't leave them laid to waste with nitrates, phosphorus, and other bacteria and poisons. It has to be culturally and socially integrity. It means it doesn't hurt the neighbors or ruin their lifestyle or destroy their day-to-day life. And it has to be economically sound, which means the farm, to be sustainable, a farm is really supposed to be run on the resources that it has locally. In this case, they're going to import grain because they know they can't grow enough grass to feed the cows. They're going to export the product to be treated, pasteurized, bottled, sold, and distributed where Medigal chooses later elsewhere. So the product's not staying here. What's staying here is the waste and the byproducts and the poisons and the bad stuff. And, you know, I mean, Amy Hennessy was quoted in...
Amy Hennessy is the manager or the PR person?
She's the public spokesperson for both Ulupono and Hawaii Dairy Farms. And she was on KITV News not long ago, and she said they're very disappointed in the people of Kauai, that they're not more excited about this.
So my guess is that they themselves probably don't take seriously the concerns. They don't understand it enough. And I want to segue here to Jeffrey, because Jeffrey, I invited him in to talk about some of these other concerns, like this, a very hot issue right now, that there is all these mandatory vaccinations, which means forced vaccinations. And Jeffrey, you have followed what happened in California. Is that correct? Because they did pass that.
Yes, I was in constant contact with most of the organizers in California via social media and personal contact. And it was not reported. It was not reported. The alternative media took it over.
Let's tell them what it is. That
okay.
It is the idea that vaccinations have to be done on all school children. The idea is hit the entire population. And did they even get the homeschoolers or no homeschoolers?
It's up in the air. It's a very gray area right now, because this is one of the first times in recent history in the country that this has happened. And so homeschooling's up in the air, and people with private schools are up in the air as well. So we actually don't know, and there's a lot of people submitting opinions, a lot of legal counsel submitting opinions about how to handle this if people just simply don't vaccinate their kids and want to bring them to school. And, you know, some of the legal counsels are saying some pretty scary stuff, like CPS visits, taking your child away, things like that. So the concern is, so it's in California, it's SB, Senate Bill 277 was signed into law. And that means in July of 2016, if you have a child that is going to school and the child's not up on their vaccines, they don't get to go to public school. They're denied the right of education. And that's a big deal for a lot of people. Now, the question, the mainstream media will frame this as vaccination versus anti-vaccination, or science versus non-science. But it's actually, like you said correctly, it's a more of a question of medical choice. And the vaccines have been proven, in especially in the last couple of weeks, a lot has happened to prove the vaccines have not demonstrated their safety. And the only thing we typically hear from the politicians are vaccines are safe and effective. You say something long enough, it gets into people's heads and they believe it, but that's actually not the case. And we now have, when I say we, the public now has the documents. There's many whistleblowers that have come forward within the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, who ironically set the vaccine schedules. While I'm on that, I might as well say it. The senior scientist responsible for the safety of the MMR vaccine, which is the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, came out and said, in our seminal study, I and my co-authors committed research fraud, and I am willing, he has all the documents which have now been released, and what they did was they covered up the link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Now, until this point, it had been what a lot of mainstream media people would call a conspiracy, because there was nothing. It was just a causal relationship. It was something parents would report, but they couldn't really tie it to anything. But now we have the senior scientist of the CDC coming forward, and he is waiting to be subpoenaed. And while he's been waiting to be subpoenaed by the U.S. House of Representatives, he released all his documents, and the alternative media, instead of waiting, took those and thought it would be the public's right to know that. So with that vaccine alone, we have admitted research fraud. Now that would have to go through a court to really get down to the nitty gritty of what happened. But it from reading the documents and seeing the report, it's very clear they covered up, in my opinion, a link between autism and the MMR vaccine.
And then with the measles, mumps, and rubella, am I remembering correctly where that was shown to have the most profound impact? Was that with African American male boys
Correct. The
most? And so even in the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a lot of anger that here when they have a significant amount, I mean, it's still a minority, but there was an alarming amount of young boys that came out mentally impaired. So it's kind of like the lead in the water in Flint, Michigan. It's the same kind of population that is, you know, when you ruin somebody, I shouldn't say ruin, but damage, impair, change somebody's intellectual capacity, that's profound.
Yeah, it actually has an amazing cost on society. So it puts an amazing burden on society. In fact, a woman that's been in this studio before and is a Kauai resident, Stephanie Sinef, she came forward, and now she's a senior scientist at MIT.
Michigan Institute of Technology.
Massachusetts,
sorry. One of those M states. Okay, anyway, go on, I'm kidding.
Through her research, she said that because of the exponential growth of autism. Now, I'm only saying this to connect points. I am not saying vaccines cause autism, but we certainly don't know if they don't. So through her research, she said by 2025, she estimates 1 in 2 children will have part of an autism spectrum disorder. So that's a disorder that comes from autism. Now, that puts an amazing financial burden on society, but not only that, if that ever comes to fruition, society as we know it in the United States stops. You're either taking care of somebody with autism or you have it yourself. And that's something that no media has picked up on. That's something that no presidential candidate, I don't endorse anybody, but I believe Trump mentioned it. But that should be number one topic point, is we have an epidemic on our hands of autism and no one knows what's causing it. Yet one of the issues is the CDC's coming forward, the senior scientists, and saying, well, we hid the connection between this vaccine and autism. So my question to the legislature, now it's not just happening in Hawaii, it's happening all across the U.S. My question is, why are we mandating these vaccines? Why can't we throw some caution to the wind and say, let's keep medical choice for now, let's give parents the last word in their child's vaccinations, and get to the bottom of these whistleblowers. And he's not the only one. His name's Dr. William Thompson at the CDC. He's not the only whistleblower. There's a lot.
Well, I see that the American College of Pediatricians just this month put out new concerns about human papillomavirus vaccine, and it is profound. And here's a new word that I didn't know, but probably Bridget does, amenorrhea. I think that means like skipping your menstrual cycle. Is that what that means?
That's right.
That's kind of a smaller aspect of what's in here, but it's saying the overwhelming majority of the vaccine adverse event reporting system, 76% of these reports since 2006 with ovarian failure, premature menopause, and or amenorrhea are associated solely with Gardasil, which is this human papillomavirus vaccine that is being debated in the Senate today. It was deferred until, do you remember what date it was deferred to, Marshall? I think the 11th?
11th or 12th.
Okay, so it's deferred, but when, like, I looked on, I went on capital.hawaii.gov, and I also talked to our representative, Derek Kawakami's office, who helped discuss it with me. They didn't really take a position yet. But what we see is most of the government offices, the health offices, everybody, they're like, okay, we're okay with this. I think we're seeing that in these other immunization bills that basically, when you look at them, they seem kind of innocuous because they say, we will do whatever the Center for Disease Control and the United States government says, but we will make sure these kids are inoculated within 90 days. Now, what I haven't been able to chase down is the homeschool kids. I've had people say that it includes them, but that's probably at the federal level. But it does take out the religious and philosophical, spiritual exemptions. So it's saying anybody who's going to school has got to have this, and it's, you know, at the federal level, there's at least the implication in there that it is private and homeschooled kids, and then we have a whole other group that's out for workers anywhere near the healthcare profession. Like, even if they're, you know, cleaning the windows at the hospital, they have to have the flu shot. And so the government end of it is mostly for it. The schools weren't, because they get that people take their kids out of school. I would take mine out of school. I would, even though I did vaccinate my kids. The idea of being forced to vaccinate my children, that would be problematic. But so as I'm looking at this, there is a lot of information in here. And but when we see the individuals that don't represent some organization, almost all of them are against them. And their parents that have said there's been a problem. And so
there was a lot of anecdotal evidence, and even though I'm a nurse, Felicia, there's a lot of people in medicine that felt like I do, and that is that sometimes the vaccines were given too early, and they're given to children that aren't having the exposure issues, that aren't socializing yet with other children.
Like hepatitis B on the first day of life,
right,
when you need to be a drug addict and IV user and maybe having unsafe sex. It seems like day one is a little early.
Yeah. And so there are a lot of people in medicine that feel that they could be pushed back to where the child's a little more mature, brain's a little more developed, they're at a safer age. Also, there's another thing going on in that the correlation between the MMR and autism. There's other factors in society that I think the CDC now is looking at as well, and that is we have the herbicide, pesticide being used, are neurotoxins. And I think there is a body of research that is going to find that it's probably a concomitant effect. In other words, there's probably a number of factors. Our diet is changing because we're now ingesting foods that have traces of glyphosate, have traces of atrazine, have traces of this chlorpyrifos, I can hardly pronounce it, which made the Syngenta workers so sick. So, you know, they use those in growing the vegetables and preparing the seed to make them resistant.
Plus, they got their cell phone in their pocket. I need to say, you're listening to KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. Continue.
So you put a neurotoxin, like the herbicide and pesticide, together with an inoculation, and we don't know what happens. And there is an astronomical rise in autism in the U.S. compared to other countries. So something is definitely contributing, and I totally agree that parents should be able to make the choice. And if they make the choice not to inoculate, I think there should be maybe laws that help guide the parents so that the child is taken out of the exposure to other children, because inoculations aren't 100%. Kids can get inoculated and still come down with the illness. Mostly it's pregnant moms that get really hurt, because the babies then become maldeveloped when the mom is exposed and gets something like measles or mumps or rubella. And so that's a real danger. I mean, the children tend to survive those viruses. A number of us that are old enough had them.
I had almost all of them.
Yeah. And so, you know, but if we were carrying our first precious child and we came down with it, it would not be so good. So it's probably going to be determined someday as a concomitant effect, compounded by all the chemicals that are now in our environment.
Right, and that's what I think makes it so hard for each entity that is being held accountable, whether it's a pesticide or a food product or the manufacturer of a pharmaceutical, whatever it is, they say, hey, it wasn't my fault, but collectively it becomes the problem.
Yeah, you know, also too, that's a great point. And the glyphosate and all the things that are in the food might be medical contradictions at some point. So if you're not eating organic at some point, maybe that's a check in a box where you say, I can't get vaccinated because I'm not eating organic, or whatever the case may be in the future. One of the concerns with the mandatory vaccination law that comes to mind for me is, now, it's great to have you sitting next to me, Bridget, with your background. It keeps me on point here. One of the basic effects of a law is it should act equally on all sections of the population, regardless of race and regardless of class, status, culture, et cetera, et cetera. And when you have a mandatory vaccination law, what that does is it discriminates against people that don't either have the community support, the family support, maybe single mothers or fathers, or the money to take their kids out of school to homeschool them or to put them in a private school. And that's another concern that a lot of people don't consider is, and the state has no backup. The state has no backup at this point. It is, you can either come in or you can go away. Mm-hmm. And where do you go? And that's the question. And that law is a discriminatory law by nature.
It is.
Yeah, there's a lot of profound challenges that are happening. So if people want to look at what's going on, and I definitely recommend reading the letters and the testimonies, then you understand a little bit more what your legislator's looking at. You know, I would say the overwhelming government aspects are supportive of these. I think that, like, the insurance companies, that everybody's kind of trying to be in alignment with what is expected of them. But if people go to capital.hawaii.gov, and even when it says search for another measure, you can put something in like vaccinations. Like, one piece that I did do a search on was judges and election of judges, and there is four bills that are up that impact the judges. And I haven't gone deep on them, but I did do a little crowd sourcing. That's a nice thing that's happening these days. You can put something out on Facebook, and I tag my friends that are lawyers that are pretty deep on understanding the legislature and the structure of government here. And they said, yes, you know, this is something that is going to influence who gets chosen as judges. And so there are four bills, three in the Senate, one in the House, that relates to the selection and retention of judges and justices. I looked for that because we this year have had at least five decisions by our Supreme Court and one of the lower courts that backed up the common person. Certainly one example that was unexpected was on the 30-meter telescope Mauna Kea conflict. The court said, you know what, the state broke its own laws. They did not go through the legal process of doing a permit and basically sidelined and kept aside a very legitimate complaint. And so that changed. Also, the Department of Land and Natural Resources was held accountable by the court for not managing the Pohakuloa crater well. That's over there on on Hawaii Island, where the military does all their practicing. It sided with the people against an expansion of a hotel right down there in Waikiki, where it blocks everybody's view. So having enough decisions that were put forward that sided with the people and not with the state, and it's embarrassing to watch the state in these court cases. Some of them have been live, and you see they just go in unprepared. I would fire that lawyer, but you can tell they didn't expect to really even have to be held accountable. They're almost stunned that they're being asked these questions. So
I know it's really incredible. I mean, we had a case go down on Oahu with a metal recycler who was storing, you know, engines and oils and things that would leak and drain really harmful fluids. They were storing them in a storm ditch. They were storing the parts in the storm ditch. And so every time it rained hard, a storm ditch would come through and there'd be rust and all the various acids and things that are used in cars and parts that would then go into the
water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the State Department of Health actually filed an amicus brief in favor of the metal recycler. And
wow.
Fortunately, the state judge said, are you kidding me? You think this is not a violation of the Clean Water Act? You want to run that by me again? And, I mean, he slammed them. I mean, there's a written opinion that people can get. And there's an environmentalist on Oahu who follows things like this pretty closely, and that's Carol Cox. And he has a website, carolcox.com, and he actually got transcripts of the hearings because he was so blown away. He went and listened to it, and he ordered the transcripts, and he has it on his site.
And when did that happen? How long ago was that?
I want to say the fall. Maybe.
So recent, within the last year.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Within the last
Much
year.
Much less than a year. Yeah.
So that's good to know. I saw one bill that I liked. It's a proactive bill, and it is on the use of camera drones, in that saying that you need to have a warrant before you use a camera drone when you're looking at somebody, that we don't have drones in the police department. But I think that that's a good proactive one. I wouldn't want drones running around just looking for problems. It seems like that would be a big loss. I do want to bring up the Iowa caucus. We have the presidential elections, and that was the first vote that came out. And so we saw Ted Cruz won in the Republican, and then next to that was Donald Trump, and then I believe it went Marco Rubio.
That's correct.
That's correct. And then in the Democrat, it was pretty much a tie between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. A very interesting thing I saw was that six of those polling places has a coin toss, and every single one of the six went in favor of Hillary Clinton. That is, you know, a statistical anomaly. So that did get her that little half a point that makes her the winner.
Three-tenths of a point.
Three-tenths of a point that makes her the winner. But what I do want to, like, I like Bernie Sanders. I like most of his message. I don't like every single piece of it. One piece I don't like is he is for mandatory vaccination.
And he's older. You know, he's kind of like me. And we did. When vaccines came out, kids that went to school in Hawaii, when I was in kindergarten and first grade, you know, once the vaccines were here, they got vaccinated or they didn't go to school. And that's, you know, so that's where he's coming from.
Well, you know, actually, when I look at what happened back then, like, we didn't know to have a choice. We just went in and got all our shots, and I got my shots. When you look at graphs of when clean sanitation came in and you look at when vaccination came in, they almost coincided with each other. Sometimes clean sanitation came in ahead of the vaccination. And so when you look at the curve, clean sanitation might be part of what has stopped a number of these diseases that were there. So it can, those things also can have multiple cases. But we didn't have near the amount. I mean, children in their first 2 years have something like 36 vaccinations.
Yeah.
It's a tremendous amount. I don't think that we really got our shots till we were in school.
That's right. And nowhere near the number that they're getting today.
Yeah, so you're not getting it on day one. You're getting it when you're 6 years old or 7 years old.
Yeah.
It's a little bit older than that. So that's a concern for me.
And we don't have the neurotoxins and the herbicides and pesticides either.
We didn't then.
No.
We did not. So Jazz with John is coming up in 15 minutes. Jeffrey, I'm going to have you, and then I'm going to have Bridget. I would like to have you get the main points out that you think are most important. I'm going to give you like 3 or 4 minutes to really be able to share it.
Okay. In 1986, Ronald Reagan created what was called the National, or he signed an act, the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, and that created the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. Since that's been created, and this is all searchable, and anything I say is searchable, it has nothing to do with me, I'm just the reporter. So since that's been created, $3.5 billion has been paid out to vaccine injured. These are children with serious adverse reactions, life threatening and sometimes death. So I want to say that because when you hear a politician or a senator or anybody saying vaccines are safe, they're not safe. And I'm not saying they're not dangerous, but I want to do away with they're perfectly safe, because that's simply not true. And I would hope that would simply have the mother or the father out there or the community or the family just start to do your own research. And secondly, when you are given a vaccination is essentially a medical procedure, and there are rules that need to be followed on medical procedures, and one of them is to know all the side effects. And what is happening now is the mothers and fathers are not getting the actual vaccine inserts that are required by law, and those show the entire list of complications that may happen. So what that happens at that point, that is not true informed consent. And some of these vaccines, for instance, have not been tested for certain things. So they have not been tested for carcinogenic properties, which is cancer-causing properties. And that means that if you're not given the proper informed consent and these vaccines have not been tested for certain things, you're actually, the person receiving the vaccine is actually part of the test. You're part of the final phase of testing. And when that idea starts to be dug a little further down, that falls into the Nuremberg codes of experimentation. And that basically was set up during World War II, and it said you need full informed consent. Now, one of the arguments as well with the flu shot, now I would like to say that in 2015, the Centers for Disease Control said the flu shot was only 23% effective, and that was their official numbers. So given the adjuvants and the chemicals, that's something that every parent would have to weigh on their own, is always look and see the effectiveness. There's always alternative media reporting on the effectiveness of it. But please go online and read the inserts, because lots of doctors and health professionals do not give the full set of inserts. So it's up to you to figure out what's going on. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, if you're expecting the mainstream media to cover this, I'm a single journalist doing this unpaid, and I am one of the first people, if not the first, to write about this story in Hawaii. And I have to say I'm saddened by that. I'm absolutely saddened by that. There's not any mainstream coverage on vaccines, and the reason that is, and this has been reported, is 70% of the revenue for one of the mainstream media stations, I'm not going to say which one, it comes from pharmaceutical revenue, and that was from the station manager. That's on non-election years, so that would not count for this year, but the reason you don't hear about pharmaceutical drugs, you don't hear about vaccine injuries or the $3.5 billion paid to the injuries, is because that's their ad revenue, that's their cash cow, and they cannot report on that. If you do not believe me, there's a woman called Cheryl Atkinson, and she left the station. She was a NBC reporter, award-winning NBC reporter. She left the station, and that was one of the reasons she left, is because there's a complete wall of reporting on that.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. And Bridget, as we come over to you, you're older than Jeffrey.
A wee bit.
And so you must remember the time of polio.
I do.
And then also what I do remember is smallpox. When I was little, there still was smallpox. People would have the scarred faces of smallpox. So some examples of success, and they might be complicated success, but it seems like we don't have smallpox anymore. Is that correct?
That is correct. I think one way to look at it too, Felicia, that Jeff is saying, is that it's the issue of the informed consent and being given the patient's right to choose. Because if you go through a surgical procedure, a lot of times they'll tell you there's a 1 in 100 chance that you're going to have a complication on the table from that procedure, or there's a 4 in 100 chance. So, you know, if you're the 1 in 100 or you're the 4 in 100 that have a real bad adverse reaction to the procedure they're about to do on you, it's real impactful. I mean, it's, you know, bad. So I think that what he's saying is true. If we give informed consent for surgeries, we give informed consent for blood draws. And I think the flu shots, I noticed a lot of times they seem to be doing a pretty good job now with the literature. They hand everybody the literature, but he's right. Parents go into pediatrics and get inoculations, and they're not given anything.
So what about polio? Like, I didn't have friends with polio, but I had friends who had parents with polio. Did you have exposure to people who got polio?
Yes, I did.
And I know even people like Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, different people like that, they had polio.
Right.
Is it your opinion that the polio vaccine worked? I mean, something worked.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the polio vaccine is believed to have been what eradicated polio from the Western world.
I think if I was able to give my kid a shot that guaranteed they weren't going to get cancer, I would be pretty up for that one. I think if people could get a shot that guaranteed they weren't going to get AIDS or something like that, that people would probably go for it. I know that, like, even in my generation, I'm a little bit older than Jeffrey, probably even more so for him, a lot of these illnesses that were there are gone now. And for many of us, like, you know, I had all those things, chickenpox, measles, mumps, rubella. It wasn't the end of the world. Did it hurt? Yes. And I seem to have them all on Christmas. But different Christmases, not the same one, but I seem to get those at Christmas time. But
a lot of viruses thrive in the winter.
A lot of viruses thrive in the winter. So, you know, for many of us, our memory isn't as profound as the people who were recovering from polio or who, you know, had a life ever changed from it. So there's that. Bridget,
yes.
Few minutes, your final thoughts.
I think I would just encourage people of Kauai and the entire state, anybody listening, get involved if you can at all, particularly where it's water issues. Water is going to be a big issue all over the U.S. It already is in many, many states. Water is so degraded that it's not safe to drink. People are having to import water. We're a small island, and these particular wells that you were talking about, Felicia, where they're actually a trapped well up in a lava rock formation, there's a name for that. I'm sorry it doesn't come to me, but they hold big bodies of fresh water. And if you talk to the people at U.S. Geological Services, they'll teach you that they do have to be really careful at what they do at what level. And we know the water tables, for instance, at Mahalapu, because we've been studying it, some of them are really high. They're within 18 inches of the surface. And so it's kind of a big deal. And you can't catch the bacteria with any kind of trap that's available today. So, you know, the group of people I'm working with are saying, let's put these operations that have bad fallout in safer spots. Find a place with deep soil. Find a place with lots of acreage to handle the waste. Because there are places in the U.S. where it's done safely, and there's places where they've tried to overcrowd, and they're facing a disaster. The federal courts have had to impose huge fines. I mean, a cow palace in Washington is having to import all the water for the citizens that live in the area. They're having to pay for it. And, you know, we just don't want that. Plus, our tourism isn't going to survive it. We're a tourism-driven island, like it or not, but that is our mainstay, and we can't afford to lose it. Out of the South Shore comes over $26 million annually just in property taxes, property tax revenue to run the county of
Hawaii. Yeah, it's a third of our taxes. So.
Well, it's about a fourth. But you take that away, you impact all of Kauai. And the flies travel 4 miles. That's been established in all of the literature. We have our own entomologist on island who's contributed and weighed in and written to the governor and written to the mayor. And he said it's real common for biting flies to travel 4 miles. There's going to be billions of biting flies with the amount of waste. There'll be odor.
So there's a lot of impact on that. I do invite the Dairy Hawaii Dairy Farms to come in here. Next week we're going to have Syngenta in. They're going to be, the management are going to be talking about the incident that happened on January 20th, and, you know, I will be kind and listen as we're talking. I know it's very difficult for them. They will be taking some calls. I'll be taking, you know, questions beforehand, too. So my little piece that I'm just giving out as my final thing is people, please, well, I can't say that. I would hope that many people would take interest and pay attention to what's going on, because it is so required of the average citizen to look at what's happening. And write letters. Because if all that you do, if you don't go to the meetings, if you don't write the letters, you can bet the people who are paid to represent the interests that make money on it are going to be there. It's their job, and they will continue to do it, and they're not even bad. They are just doing what they're supposed to be doing for their job, and the rest of us...
But they're influenced by the people that contribute to their campaigns. They can't help be. And it sounds good to them. I mean, recently we had the Department of Agriculture regurgitate back to one of the members of our community exactly what Hawaii Dairy Farms puts on their website, you know, that it's going to somehow bring all this money to Kauai. But how? There's just 15 jobs.
Right.
You know, so he doesn't say how. He just repeats the same mantra.
That's right. So we are just about gone. Marshall, do you have a last thought?
Did you mention the Pioneer Settlement?
I did not mention the Pioneer Settlement. I'm going to leave that for the people who are in the settlement and not talk about it on
okay.
the radio.
All right.
But I do hear lots of things, and that kind of goes back to judges and what works for our court system. We are going to hear about the declare your love. Like if you love somebody for $10, it's going to be blasted out on KKCR. It's another way to help us with our funding. Then we are going to hear the county council report. There's two county councils meetings this week, one on Wednesday, and then on Thursday they're doing the county manager position. So any last thought? No, he says no. Okay, thank you so much, everybody, for coming. This is Felicia with Kauai Soapbox. Love, love me do. You know I love you. I'll always be true. So please declare your love on KKCR. Donate $10 or more to KKCR by Friday, February 11, and hear your declaration of love announced on KKCR during every live show from 7 a.m. to midnight on Valentine's Day, Sunday, February 14. More information online at kkcr.org or call 808-826-7774.
Love me too.
And Jazz with John is coming up next. He always does such an amazing job. We hope that everybody does support Kauai Community Radio. So the county council, he's looking really quick for me to try and see if we have one or two council meetings today. We sort of have a thought that it could be that there are... two. So I'm going to play this county council report, and then John will have been checking it. He's seeing one for tomorrow. Okay, and then do you see the one for Thursday?
I don't see Thursday.
Okay, maybe doesn't see Thursday. All right, John knows. Hey, John, thank you so much.
That's the committee.
Aloha, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Here's a county council report for the week of February 1st. There will be a council committee meeting at 8:30 a.m. on Wednesday, February 3rd. The meeting will be in the council chambers in Lihue. And here are highlights from the meeting agenda. For the Public Works, Parks, and Recreation Committee, the county engineer recommends council approval of a conveyance of easement by Lihue Court Townhomes Corporation, a nonprofit Hawaii corporation, of a right-of-way easement necessary for construction of a public access to the Ola Street to Rice Street shared use path, a community development block grant-funded project for pedestrian and bicycle access to Lihue Court Townhomes, Rice Camp Senior Housing, and the area around Ola Street. This was referred January 27, 2016. The Planning Committee has on their agenda Bill 2601 for an ordinance amending the county code relating to additional dwelling units on other than residentially zoned lots, and a public hearing was held on this on January 27th. The Budget and Finance Committee has Bill 2610 on their agenda, and this is a bill for an ordinance to establish a general excise and use tax surcharge for the County of Kauai. Public hearing held on this on January 27th. Also on their agenda is Bill 2611 for an ordinance amending an ordinance relating to the capital budget of the county for the fiscal year July 1, 2015 through June 30, 2016, revising the amounts estimated in the bond fund, and this is for the Honolulu Base Yard Fuel Tank Project, $40,000. Public hearing held on January 27th. The Committee of the Whole has a request from Council Chair Raposo for agenda time to discuss a charter amendment implementing the county manager system, schedule public workshops regarding the county manager system, solicit assistance from the ICMA, and have a member of the Charter Review Commission update the committee on the status of its proposal to implement the county manager system. And this was deferred from January 21st. Please visit www.kauai.gov/webcast meetings to view meetings or meeting archives. Until next week, I'm John Gordon for KKCR News. Aloha. And you are listening to KKCR Honolulu, KAQA Kilauea. Stand by for Jazz with John coming up next. And Jazz with John is made possible.